from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, columnist Marcus Bertone's take on some of the top stories in the news. Also, author and writing teacher Ethan Kanan. His books include The Palace Thief, and one of his short stories was turned into the Kevin Kline movie, The Emperor's Club. And a one-man play about Lee Atwater opens this week. You'll meet the actor and hear a scene. But first, NPR's new president and CEO is in town. Vivian Schiller joined the network at the start of this year. She came from the New York Times, where she ran nytimes.com, the nation's most viewed newspaper website. How does she see the future of public radio and online media? She joins us. Vivian Schiller, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, running NPR is a pretty big job, but so is running the New York Times website. Why did you move to public radio?
How could I not? It was such an amazing opportunity to run such an incredibly important news organization, and a news organization that touches so many people's lives. This is no disrespect to the New York Times. I'm still very fond and believe very much in their mission. But the opportunity for NPR and public radio, especially now with journalism in such crisis, or the business model of journalism in such crisis, was very compelling. And if that were not enough, my family actually lives in the Washington area. I'd been commuting to New York, so this made my commute a lot shorter.
When you say the business model for journalism is in crisis, obviously you're referring to newspapers, most of which have been losing money for some time now. But NPR has had to cancel shows, has had to lay off a whole bunch of staff. There have been furloughs and so on. Isn't the crisis there too?
That's very true. Look, the economic crisis, speaking of another crisis of the last year, has hit everyone, and NPR was not immune. We did have to cancel two shows, one of which I understand aired here in Sacramento day to day. And that was very difficult for us as an organization. But, it's been widely reported a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. So it was really an opportunity, even though it was difficult for us to sort of rebalance our budget, look at how we're doing things. And I feel like we're now very well positioned for the future.
My guest is Vivian Schiller, president and CEO of National Public Radio. She's visiting Sacramento today. There has been speculation that some for-profit news organizations might turn to or experiment with the nonprofit model, as you see at NPR. Do you buy that? Do you think it's likely to happen or succeed?
Do I buy that they're talking about it? I buy that they're talking about it, and there's been quite a bit written about it. It actually makes me laugh sometimes when I see some writing by some people who are not really, frankly, all that informed about how the not-for-profit business model works, that it's almost this sort of magical solution that if you have a lot of debt, if your expenses are exceeding your revenues, that you declare yourself a not-for-profit and poof, all of your problems disappear. Well, a not-for-profit organization like NPR still has to run like a business. We still have to make money. We still have to cover our costs and then some. So the notion that the not-for-profit model is some kind of silver bullet, of course, is quite silly. Having said that, I think some. So I don't know that that's really going to happen for any big news organizations, or if it is, I think they're in for a rude surprise. But some news organizations are looking at some aspects of what has been a fairly successful model for public radio, which is donations from listeners, readers, or what have you, and certainly. We in public radio don't have a lock on listener or reader donations. There's no reason, it's far be it for me to tell a news organization they shouldn't do it. But it does raise some tricky issues, I think, for the public in understanding what it is they are, quote unquote, donating to.
Would NPR and public radio stations be worried that the New York Times, LA Times, the Sacramento Bee, whatever, could be moving into their turf, and that could ultimately undermine the finances of public radio?
I suppose on one level, yes. But my concern really is more of a different one, which is confusion to the audience about what it means to donate. When you donate to your public radio station, there is an understanding or a knowledge, and if there's not a knowledge, there should be, that you are donating to a mission-driven organization where all of the money is going towards the actual endeavor, in this case, news, information, and cultural programming. When you donate to and there's also obviously tax implications, et cetera. When you donate to a commercial enterprise, it's important to understand, and again, far be it from me to tell somebody they shouldn't donate any place they choose to, but it's important to understand what you're donating to when it's a company that is publicly owned, where it's about creating shareholder value. And ultimately, where is your donation going to? Is it going to investors and shareholders, or is it going back into the business?
In an interview earlier this year with Newsweek magazine, you said news is a commodity. I'm sorry to say. Why did you say that? What did you mean by that?
Well, I'm a dyed in the wall, you know, I supporter of journalism and always have been. That was not implied to mean that journalism is not important. Legitimate journalism is more important than ever, especially as sources of it begin to go away or cut back. What that line was in reference to was in the debate that's happening in many circles in media now about whether news organizations should charge for online content. And what I was suggesting and firmly believe is that news organizations should not, and including commercial news organizations, put their content behind a paywall, because I don't believe that people that large numbers of people will pay for news services, except for very specific forms of news.
The Wall Street Journal being a prominent exception.
Well, it is an exception. I think that people will pay for, you know, in-depth financial reporting, certain kinds of sports reporting, certain kinds of local reporting that is about specific information that is needed. But when we're talking about news coverage that is coming from many sources, in that sense, it has become commoditized. And whether we like it or not, I may think, for instance, that NPR's news coverage is the best in the world. But the fact is, if we were to go pay, not that we're going to, we will not, we never will, people will just be driven away and look elsewhere.
And I guess your thoughts on this are in part driven by your experience at NYTimes.com,
yes,
which used to charge for some access to
That's
columnists
right.
and so on, and you ended that.
I did.
Was bringing in about $10 million a year. I'm sure the New York Times didn't want to say no to $10 million. Why did you end the charging for content?
Well, because it was holding back access to information to our audience, which was not just about sort of a public service. It was also a very much a business decision. The New York Times, though mission-driven that may be, and it's an exceptional news organization, don't get me wrong, but it is a for-profit organization. And it was our firm belief that in cleaving off part of the content, the columnists, it was mostly the columnists in the archive, we were cutting ourselves off from a large number of audience, and especially because of the archive, from being accessible to search. And in fact, when we ended Time Select, which was $10 million a year, but against, you know, between $100 and $200 million in ad revenue, that we saw our traffic surge by close to 100%. So it's, you know, it was important during that time to have as large an audience as possible. I firmly believe it was the right decision at the time.
Vivian Schiller, president and CEO of National Public Radio. There was a mild controversy earlier this year over NPR's decision to cancel almost all newspaper subscriptions. There was a newspaper columnist in Connecticut who took you to task over that, essentially saying, hey, news gathering costs money. If a news organization isn't willing to pay for it, why should anyone, including people listening to NPR?
Well, there was a controversy. It was very ironic for me, you know, having just come from the New York Times and then going to NPR and then being, you know, vilified by a few people in canceling our newspaper subscriptions. I mean, I don't work for the New York Times. I don't represent the New York Times. But I will tell you that my reaction when I had been there, if someone had told me they'd cancel their newspaper subscriptions, my reaction would be, so be it. I mean, we made a decision at the New York Times to provide our content, all of our content, for free, with the notion of let the audience decide. If the audience chooses, certainly we hope that people will, you know, at the time we hoped that people would continue their newspaper subscriptions, and indeed they have in large numbers. But it is not for us to tell people how they should consume news. And any news organization, and NPR included, public radio stations included, that is resting their future on trying to force a certain kind of audience behavior is in for a rude awakening. It should be the opposite. The audience should be telling us how they want to consume their content, and it is up to us, any news organization, to deliver it the way the audience wants it.
Another mild but ongoing controversy is over pay. Not too long ago, the Chronicle of Philanthropy published executive salaries at nonprofits. The Washington Post recently published Washington nonprofit salaries. And it reminds people that top people in public radio, top talent, top executives make, compared to most people, a lot of money. Of course, compared to their counterparts in commercial media, they don't make nearly so much money. How do you, as the top executive at National Public Radio, handle this? NPR is a big media organization. It's also a nonprofit.
Right. Well, certainly our salaries are a fraction of our colleagues in broadcast. Before I was at the New York Times, I worked at Discovery and CNN, so I can tell you firsthand the salaries at all levels are much smaller than they are in commercial broadcasting, as well they should be. Having said that, we are a professional organization. We hire professional executives and professional journalists, and we need to pay them appropriately. You know, people that come to work at NPR understand that they are giving up a certain amount of earning power when they come there, and I did as well. Because they care about what they're doing. But in order to both attract and retain talent, we have to pay, you know, reasonably decent salaries. I think that's just the cost of doing business. Again, having said that, it's much smaller across the board than it is the commercial counterparts.
You had a slightly unusual path into the media, although I guess a lot of people would probably say that about themselves. Your university degrees are in Russian and Russian studies, and you were a tour guide in Russia,
right.
The Soviet Union, I guess, at that time in the 80s. And that's how you got connected to Turner Broadcasting.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Well, I know as many people do that are in various careers, you end up getting calls from neighbors and colleagues saying, you know, my son or daughter is thinking of going to journalism. Will you meet with them and tell them how, you know, the path to get into this profession? I always laugh because I took the most ridiculously circuitous path into this profession that you could possibly have. I was, in fact, after college, a Russian tour guide and a Russian interpreter in the former Soviet Union. And it's really, quite frankly, completely by accident that I ended up in media. Although, you know, the funny thing about looking at my career path at the time, you know, that I've made each change in my career has seemed sort of random. But the interesting thing is now when I look back, it all sort of makes sense in retrospect, which is sort of an interesting thing. But I was a Russian tour guide and interpreter, and I was hired by Turner Broadcasting in 1988 because at the time, Ted Turner, who was still very active in leading the company, had decided that he single-handedly was going to end the Cold War. I don't know that he did single-handedly. I think Ronald Reagan may have had something to do with it, but he certainly did contribute. He launched the Goodwill Games, and he was involved with all kinds of activities. And they hired me really to be what's called in broadcasting and in media, a fixer, which means I was basically a flunky and an interpreter, and I would travel with the highest level executives at the time, being very young and very new to media, to the Soviet Union, and I would do whatever needed to get done, make restaurant reservations, get them into the people they needed to see, and be an interpreter, which allowed me to be a fly on the wall and learn sort of at the heels of some major media executives, and that began my love of media and my interest in media.
Well, before that, when you were at university studying Russian, what did you think you would be?
I had no idea. I absolutely had no idea. I just knew that, you know, I love this and it was so interesting and I was fascinated by the country, the culture, the literature, the history, the language. And I went over to the Soviet Union so I could learn the language better. And, you know, my parents asked me that every day. What are you going to do with this? I really didn't know. I thought, you know, a path would emerge, and indeed it has.
Do you still speak Russian?
Not very well. I really could. I could probably find my way around Moscow asking directions. But boy, being an interpreter is not like riding a bicycle. It doesn't come back to you instantly. You have to really work at it.
Finally, Vivian, a lot of people who listen to public radio think that it's all NPR, including the stations, including the networks, distributors that are not part of NPR. But wouldn't the whole thing be more efficient if it was all just one big NPR?
No, absolutely not. You're right. There is a lot of confusion. When I tell people that I work for NPR, the most common response I get is, I love that station. Well, of course, NPR is not a station. NPR is a news organization. We create news programs like Morning Edition and All Things Considered. We have 36 bureaus around the country, 17 bureaus overseas. But we provide news and information and news programs to the stations. The stations are the heart and soul of and the strength and the secret sauce of the public radio system. You know, I like to remind people when they say, oh, I love that station about NPR. So you love is not NPR you love, where I live, WAMU, or what you love is here, Capital Public Radio, because the experience that you're getting through your local station is the seamless experience of the local and regional, which, of course, is very strong here at this station, the coverage, and the national and international. There is no such thing as an NPR experience. It is the experience of the station, and that is our strength, that we are tied in, that we are a network of 880 stations that have roots in the community, bricks and mortar, in the community, relationship with the community, and that is what makes us strong and so unique in media.
Vivian Schiller, President and CEO of National Public Radio. She's visiting Sacramento today. Vivian, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Sacramento Bee columnist Marcus Bertone. We'll talk about some of the top stories in the news, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Email us suggestions for future topics. Our address is insight@capradio.org. Coming up in Talk of the Nation, how does society decide when people are old enough to do something? For example, why can you buy a car at age 18 but not rent one? That's Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. It's the first Wednesday of the month. Time to talk about top stories in the news with Sacramento Bee columnist Marcus Bertone. Marcus, welcome back.
Thank you.
Today, you write about ammunition sales, as a bill in California would require a thumbprint if you buy ammo. And you quote Sheriff John McGinnis saying most criminals get their ammunition illegally. Uh-huh. If that's true, why does California need a law to regulate non-criminals getting ammunition for guns they illegally own?
It's an interesting question, Jeffrey. I took up the issue in today's column because this effort is minuscule. At best, there is a similar ordinance in Sacramento. It has netted 100 some odd indictments of very dumb criminals who actually go to the store and leave their thumbprint. When if they'd read the criminal manual, they would see that buying it illegally would be much safer for them. But I took up the issue for this reason. It's a very small, modest measure, and yet it's assailed from all sides by the gun lobby and by people who see the Second Amendment and see no given it whatsoever. And I wanted to focus on it to show that when we're talking about attempts to curb gun violence, that we're at the point now where you just can't have the discussion without getting creamed. I'm getting creamed in the comment section of the Bee as we speak. Yes. I mean, I woke up very early this morning, and it wasn't even light out yet, and they were coming fast and furious already. And so in this issue, if you focus on the ordinance in Sacramento, we're talking about leaving a thumbprint when you buy certain kinds of ammunition. Okay, now we leave a thumbprint when we go get our driver's license. All right. So, and the people who would get in trouble are convicted felons who aren't supposed to have ammunition. The store owners aren't being hassled, and if you don't have a record, there's not going to be a problem. And yet, even with the district attorney in Sacramento County and the police chief being very effusive about the program, even this incurs the wrath of people who don't want to have any kind of discussion about it, and so it is reflective of the culture that we're talking about.
You started your column today by writing, "You can't talk about controlling violence without getting dismissed as a liberal hater of the Second Amendment." Yeah. Dare I ask the Stephen Colbert-like question? Are you a liberal hater of the Second Amendment?
I'm not. I'm really not. And you know, the commenters today are proving my point. You know, the word liberal is hurled like a rock indiscriminately. And it's funny, the last week's column, I was being called a right-wing media slug, and today it's a left-leaning liberal. Look, this law does not take guns out of the hands of law-abiding people. I'm not in favor of that. I really don't have strong opinions on it. I mean, I've shot guns a few times in my life. Okay, I don't see this as a be-all, end-all issue. Some people do, and in this case, good things have happened in Sacramento. 100 of the dumbest criminals around have been arrested. They've gone through the justice system. There were 14 federal indictments. Again, very small, minuscule numbers. But even the smallest, most minuscule effort at trying to deal with this epidemic of gun violence, it incurs the wrath of good, well-meaning people who just can't see anything beyond, who see everything as an attack on their Second Amendment rights. And to me, the Second Amendment should not be a shield for felons, and I kind of think we're at that point right now.
Marcus Bertone, Sacramento Bee columnist. His columns are published Wednesdays and Sundays. He's on Inside the first Wednesday of each month. Let's talk now about Meg Whitman, the former eBay executive who's running for governor as Republican. And the Bee did a story a few days ago about her very spotty lifelong voting and registration record, including registering as a Republican. She seems to be fighting back a little bit today, and her campaign says that she has clear memories of voting in the 80s.
Well, she didn't have clear memories last week when she was apologizing and going on record that her voting record is atrocious. Her words, not mine.
Does it matter, though? I mean, could you imagine voting for someone for governor who had rarely voted?
I suppose it matters, because it matters to her and her campaign, because the story wasn't going away. And I'm a fan of Facebook and Twitter, and it's been on those two platforms. It hasn't gone away. And so it's my opinion that her campaign is taking a calculated strategy to try to stem the tide. And try to change the subject, because the issue wasn't going away and was, you know, I don't want to use over-salacious word, but it was a campaign, particularly at its beginning stages, does not need this. And so they need to change the subject, and they're trying to kill the messenger, as it were.
We've got two rich people running for governor on the Republican side.
Right.
You've got Meg Whitman and Steve Poizner, and you've got a guy who isn't rich, Tom Campbell. They all are somewhat moderate, at least by Republican standards. Yeah. What do you think is going to come out of all this?
Nothing good, in the sense that, you know, we have a moderate governor who's a rich, famous guy, and one of his biggest problems is not being able to be in sync with his own party. And so you can be a moderate all you want. Governor Schwarzenegger certainly is. There are some people who even feel that he's a Democrat in Republican clothing. That certainly hasn't done him any favors with his own party at the Capitol. And so maybe one of these people are more skillful than the Governor Schwarzenegger is. But it still seems to put you at odds with the majority of your member of your party, of the representatives who actually work in the Capitol.
Yeah, it just kind of reminds me of 1998 when Gray Davis, who was a wonky guy without much money, was supposed to be toast up against two very rich Democrats.
Yeah.
And he, of course, prevailed, but we know how all that turned out.
Yeah, that turned out really well for Gray. You know, I don't know. We're still, obviously, the fact that these campaigns crank up so early is really kind of preposterous. But, you know, Tom Campbell has been around for a long time, and he's run for a number of offices. So it really is Poizner and Whitman at this point. I think it's theirs to lose, as it were, and they really are struggling to sort of establish themselves.
The Bee's City Hall reporter Ryan Lillis wrote a story the other day about tension at City Hall. And one thing he wrote was interesting to me, and that was this perception that perhaps the city staff are withholding controversial matters from the agenda because of all the tension in City Hall. And apparently something similar happened, or might have happened, a year ago when things were very tense when Heather Fargo was the mayor. And if that's the case, that seems rather sad.
Yeah, you know, Sac City Hall is a bit of a sad little building these days. I agree with the premise of the story, simply on the basis of many conversations with many people who either do business with the city, who people who work in the city, who speak of a real split on the council, and that and the wedge issue, as it were, was the getting the strong mayor initiative on the ballot this next summer. And there were four council people led by Councilman Rob Fong and who were really trying to delay Strom Mayor as much as possible. And then Steve Cohn and Ray Trethway and a couple of others voted with the mayor. He prevailed, and he's getting it on the ballot. And so there are antagonistic relationships on the council, and it's affecting business. And it's my opinion. I don't think that there's any doubt about that.
Finally, Marcus, let's talk about what is now a breaking sports news story, and that is Michael Crabtree, the football player who's been a holdout until now with the 49ers. He was drafted by the 49ers, has finally reached a deal. And the interesting angle on this is that MC Hammer apparently was brought in to help broker the talks yesterday. How can that be?
Well, Hammer doesn't have much to do these days. You understand. It's been a long time since he actually had a hit. Hammer is very good friends with Michael Crabtree's agent. And there's a Deion Sanders connection as well. When Deion Sanders played with the 49ers in 1994, Hammer was in his heyday as a recording artist and wearer of big floppy pants. And so that relationship has continued. And so the speculation is that Deion asked Hammer to look out for his boy while he was on the West Coast, and there was this clandestine meeting at a hotel in the South Bay last night. Then the media, as we always do, we discovered and we deployed our forces on the hotel, and there was skulking around back halls. And if you've ever had to do that, Jeffrey, it is incredibly demeaning work. I had to do that in Las Vegas when they were having arena discussions, and I was having to stay three steps ahead of the maloof goon squad of security guards. And so Hammer was, in this situation, was in the thick of it. And so the happy news for 49er faithful everywhere is that Michael Crabtree has signed his contract, and now the 49ers actually might have a receiver who can actually catch the ball, which would be novel because they don't have that right now.
And that would be a good thing for a football team.
Yeah, catching the ball is kind of critical to the fortunes of any football team, and so you need to have people who can actually catch the ball.
Marcus Bretone, his columns in the Sacramento Bee are published Wednesdays and Sundays. He's an Insight the first Wednesday of each month. Marcus Bretone, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, author Ethan Kanan. His novels include America, America, and four of his short stories have been made into films, including one that became The Emperor's Club with Kevin Kline. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can download our program details at capradio.org/insight. Author and writing teacher Ethan Kanan is coming to town. His books include novels like America, America, and collections like The Palace Thief. Several of his short stories have been made into films, including The Emperor's Club, starring Kevin Kline. Ethan Kanan is also well known among writers as a member of the faculty of the Iowa Writers' Workshop and as a co-founder of the Writers' Grotto in San Francisco. This Saturday, he'll give a writing workshop and read from his work in Grass Valley. He joins us by phone. Ethan Kanan, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey.
What's the first thing you like to tell aspiring writers who enroll at the Iowa Writers' Workshop?
Oh, the first thing I tell them is they usually won't write while they're here. It's 2 years of sort of Major League Baseball. It's high pressure. You get a lot of criticism, people telling you what you're doing wrong. And that tends to shut down a lot of writers. And I tell them that when they get out of here, they'll write. It's kind of like learning a language. First you learn the grammar. It seems impossible. And then somehow it gets internalized, and you can suddenly find yourself speaking.
So they're really doing exercises on fragments of writing as opposed to writing a big book.
No, not at all, actually. We never do. I personally never do exercises. We just read their work. A lot of them are writing novels. It's sort of a sea change in young writers today. It used to be young writers wrote short stories, and once they got the short story down, they sort of attempted the novel. And now a lot of our students come halfway through a novel. I try to get them to stop. I try to get them to write short stories because when you blow a short story, you've only blown about 2 months.
When I look over your own work, there are short stories, novellas, a short novel, full-length novels. Did you systematically go through the types of fiction to see what suited you best?
That's an interesting question. No, I didn't systematically do it. I think it's some sort of maturation of the brain, or maybe it's sort of the gradual demise of discipline. You know, when I was a kid, when I was, when I really was 19, 20 years old, I really was in love with writing. I wanted to be a writer, and even if I knew it meant I wouldn't earn a penny the rest of my life. I couldn't write a story longer than about 10 pages. All I could do would get it up to 10 pages, and now it's hard for me to keep anything under 100 or, 150. It's you just kind of, I don't know what that is. Is that laziness? Is that more discipline? Is that less discipline? Is that what? I'm interested in bigger things. Novels are more interesting to me now.
Yes.
To contain the world, to sort of take a bite at the whole world.
Ethan Kanan, author and writing teacher, is coming to Grass Valley this Saturday at the Center for the Arts. Your latest book is definitely a full-length novel, America, America. And every time it's been reviewed, people have, well, maybe not every time, but many times, people have drawn attention to the apparent similarities to the Kennedys, certainly to Ted Kennedy. It starts off with a liberal senator's funeral. I assume it was purely coincidence, that the timing.
Yeah, it was a strange coincidence. I mean, I started this book about 7 or 8 years ago. And just about when the book was published, did anybody learn of Ted Kennedy's brain cancer? And a few weeks ago when Kennedy actually died. And I was thinking about Ted Kennedy when I wrote this book, because I've always been fascinated by Chappaquiddick. It seemed to me, when I looked at it, to mark sort of the high point of American liberalism, in the sense that from that point on, the movement sort of drifted downward, because they were given opponents to liberalism were given a real sort of a poster child for what could go wrong with these sort of high living, fancy, wealthy, aristocratic men who wanted to give away money and wanted to help poor people, and sort of gave a face to all their fears that not only were they going to give away our money, but these guys weren't, our daughters weren't even safe for these men. And that, to me, marked sort of the beginning of a 20 or 30-year decline in what I call the politics of generosity more than liberalism, the politics of giving away, of caring for those who have less than you do. So it seemed like a watershed moment to me. But it's actually the book, the character in this book, who's a great liberal senator who runs for president and is sort of derailed by a Chappaquiddick-like incident. He's not really based on Kennedy at all. He's more, in my mind, based on Lyndon Johnson, which is sort of another question that interests me in the book. Johnson was also a great sort of legislator of social change, with the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and Medicare and all kinds of things that for the Great Society program. Johnson was undeniably interested in the common man, but he himself was a sort of a ruthless killer of political opponents. And that question interests me. What do you do with people like this? What do you do with politicians like this, if they're public minded in their governmental acts, and yet vicious and unsupportable in their private lives? It's not a question I have any answer to. It's a question that can keep mm-hmm. you interested, to keep me interested as I write a book for 5 or 6 years.
Some of your short stories have been turned into films. Most famously, the one that became the movie called The Emperor's Club that stars Kevin Kline. Did you see the film, and what did you make of it, especially in comparison with the story you had written?
Yeah, the story is called The Palace Thief, and I saw the film. I actually think the film is terrific. It's Hollywood, so there's always going to be things that I don't quite like about it, and there are moments I don't like about it. But I think the movie itself is really quite good and quite serious and sort of funny at the same time. And Kevin Kline is just really fabulous in it. Making a movie, I mean, the best thing about making a movie is that other people are working on it with you, and that's also the worst thing about it.
How involved, if at all, were you?
Well, I've had a number of movies made. That one was sort of, I'm in the movie for a few seconds, and I watched them film it a little bit, but I really didn't do much. And that, in the end, having done the whole gamut now in my life, from having written a screenplay and being on the set of the movie every single day to having another movie in which I didn't even know they were making it until it was done, I'd say the best way to do it is to stay away.
You said
voice of experience.
You said there were some things you didn't like about it. Was there anything significant about the Emperor's Club movie that you didn't like that you could share with us?
Yeah, you know, if anybody reads the story, it's called the Palace Thief is the name of the story, and it's also the name of the book that it's in. There's some insinuation in that story that the teacher, it's about a history teacher who sort of is up against, confronts the sort of a wealthy and powerful child, the child of wealthy and powerful parents, that is, and the story of that over 40 years, 50 years. And in the story, there's an implication that the teacher is gay and that he is being blackmailed for that. And in the movie, this being Hollywood, the teacher is not gay, and there's even a female love interest for him. So that sort of part of the story was dropped by Hollywood. But other than that, I think it's really a fine movie.
Ethan Keenan, author and writing teacher, who's coming to Grass Valley this Saturday. A few months ago on Insight, we talked with Yi-Yun Lee, the author and UC Davis professor who made a name for herself with her debut collection of short stories, A Thousand Years of Good Prayers, and her first novel is The Vagrants. And I read on your website that she's one of your former students at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. What are your memories of Yi-Yun?
Oh, she was terrific. You know, English is not her first language, so it's even more stunning that when you read work like that from someone who's writing with it's already cripplingly difficult, and to write with a fourth handicap like that is really impressive. And she came, and it's the power of the content of what she writes is sort of overwhelming. But I get that experience, two or three times a year teaching here. It's really quite delightful and inspiring to have such good students.
I can imagine. And I also read that you like working with wood. Meaning what?
Oh, I build all kinds of things. I just built a chicken tractor for our four chickens here, and it's sort of a furniture-worthy chicken tractor that runs on. You know what a chicken tractor is, Jeffrey?
I was just about to ask.
Well, I bet a lot of your listeners do. It's sort of a movable chicken house that you move each night across your lawn, and allows the chickens to eat the grubs and fertilize your lawn and stay healthy and give you nice eggs.
And you made that?
Yeah, I just built that, and it has got wheels, and it's got a number of doors on it. It's very fancy. It's like a hotel for chickens, upscale hotel for chickens.
And why do you like this? Did you grow up in that kind of woodworking environment?
No, I didn't at all. My dad can't change a light bulb, as they say. I learned it in high school. It's the only thing I remember from high school was woodshop. And, it's also an antidote to what I do, which is I spent 4 or 5 years adding black marks to paper. It's very slow. It's hard to figure. It's hard to realize. It's hard to understand that what you're doing is of any import or any consequence. Whereas you go out with a hammer and a nail gun, you can build a house in a few days. Well, that's an exaggeration. You can build a chicken house in a few days. There's something wonderful about combining the life of the mind with the life of the body. Yes. And it's a wonderful balance for me.
And finally, Ethan Keenan. Earlier in your life, it seemed like you hedged your bets a little bit. You pursued both writing and medicine. You went to Harvard Medical School. Do you ever think, maybe I could have stuck out the medicine thing?
I do think that. I sometimes wish I had, I should have been a surgeon. I actually did a residency in internal medicine. And I think that being a surgeon would be a lot actually like being a woodworker. I think I would really enjoy going back to it at this point in life. But I kind of feel I'm a little bit too far away from it at this point to really go back.
Well, when you talk about the woodworking and the surgery, you make me think of the famous Civil War surgeon. And we'll leave it at that. Ethan Keenan, author, writing teacher. He's in Grass Valley this Saturday at the Center for the Arts, giving a writing workshop in the morning at 10:30 and a reading in the evening at 7:30. Ethan Keenan, thanks for joining us.
Jeffrey, my pleasure.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a one-man play about the late Lee Atwater opens this week. You'll meet the actor and hear a scene. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Do you really like something in Insight? Tell us what it was and why at insight@capradio.org. Political consultants aren't usually the subject matter of one-man plays, but most political consultants aren't as controversial or as colorful as the late Lee Atwater. A play opening this week in Sacramento tells the story of the Republican strategist best known for signing off on the Willie Horton commercials that sealed the fate of Michael Dukakis in the 1988 presidential election. Along with a take-no-prisoners approach to politics, Atwater was also a pretty good blues musician. The play about him is called Atwater Fixin' to Die. The actor who plays Lee Atwater and the director join us, Eric Baldwin and Veda Russell. Welcome.
Hello.
Thank you.
Eric, what did you think about Lee Atwater before you started working on the show?
I think my major initial feeling was that this was a monster and to treat him like a monster. And then you start doing it and you realize, oh, that's the wrong thing to do. You've got to find the sympathy. You've got to find the areas where you kind of want to like him. If you're going to create a realistic three-dimensional portrayal.
Do you still think he's a monster, even though you also see the parts of him that are sympathetic?
I think he did monstrous things. And I think morally he was not necessarily all that aware of what he was doing. I think once he evolved into his deathbed conversion, which happened later on, and which is also in the play, he started to realize the full scope morally of what he was doing.
We have an excerpt from that famous TV ad, the Willie Horton ad from the 1988 election. It starts by saying that they were going to compare George Bush and Michael Dukakis in crime. And it said Bush supported, this is the first president, Bush supported the death penalty for first-degree murderers.
Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
Actor Eric Baldwin plays Lee Atwater, who signed off on that ad many years ago. How do you handle that episode in the play?
Well, what's particularly interesting about the commercial itself was the visual imagery behind it, too. They showed a picture of him, his mugshot, the Willie Horton, and it was a very frightening image to insulated white Americans at that time. And it was very purposeful. It was used to scare them away from maybe a more liberal governor from Massachusetts or that literally was supposedly, according to Atwater, defending the criminal who would create something like that.
Yes. Veda Russell is the director. Veda, why is this a one-man show? I mean, Atwater interacted with so many colorful characters, including Ronald Reagan and the first President Bush.
That's a good question. But there are several characters, and Eric plays all of them. And it could be cast as, you play five different characters?
Five different characters.
It could be cast with all of those characters, but we have an actor here who can handle all those characters. And very strong and very inventive choices. So it's very interesting to see how an actor in space can make all those people.
She's also my publicist, but yeah.
Yes.
Thank you for that, Veda.
Veda, is it a special challenge directing a one-man show because you've got one actor who has to hold everyone's attention for the whole time?
It is. I've directed a one-woman show many years ago, Stephanie McVeigh in Shirley Valentine. But it's, it's taking the space and finding different places to move him. Yeah, it's quite challenging.
We're talking about the play, the one-man play, Atwater Fixin' to Die. It's put on by California Stage, opening October 9th, running for about a month in Midtown Sacramento. Eric, you're going to do a scene for us. Anything we need to know before you start it?
Yeah, this scene, it's just a brief monologue involving Lee Atwater's time working political campaigns in South Carolina, and he was working for a congressional candidate named Campbell, who was running against an incumbent Democrat named Max Heller. And Max Heller was actually born in Israel, or before it became Israel, and was an immigrant to America. And Atwater coaxed a third-party candidate as an independent to kind of do some of the dirty work that he couldn't have his candidate do.
Okay, well, let's hear it.
I appreciate you coming, Mr. Sprouse. I am sorry about the hour, but we've come across some information that might be advantageous to your campaign. Well, no, we just feel that us Republicans have got to be willing to extend a friendly hand to independents if we ever going to break that Democratic stranglehold. No, I don't usually schedule strategy sessions in supermarket parking lots. I know it's not your normal way of doing business, but
What we've got here is some real sensitive stuff, and I want to make sure that nobody misinterprets our meeting, since I am an advisor to the Campbell campaign on an informal basis. So, yeah, technically we are on opposite sides in this campaign. Good. Good. I'm glad we see eye to eye on that. Well, the conventional wisdom is that our opponent, Max Heller, is the ideal candidate. He's articulate, he's attractive, and he's the most popular mayor in the state, and that is why he has beaten us by 10 points and you by 20. But according to a poll I just saw, he's got one fatal flaw. No. When we asked voters if they cared that he was foreign-born, they didn't bat an eye. The question didn't even register. But when we asked them if they would knowingly vote for a candidate who had not accepted Jesus Christ as their personal savior, bingo. Over 70% of them said, no way, never. Well, what it means, Mr. Sprouse, is that the only way you're going to beat Max Heller is to attack him for not being born again. Yeah, I know. He's Jewish. But the brilliant part of this campaign is you don't even have to bring Jewish up.
My goodness. Eric Baldwin, actor who plays Lee Atwater, the late Republican political consultant in the one-man show Atwater Fixin' to Die. It opens October 9th in Sacramento. Atwater, you know, his whole approach was take no prisoners, and he died when he was 40 of a brain tumor. And I heard that he reached out to some of the people who he had done wrong by and apologized to them, including Michael Dukakis.
Including Michael Dukakis and a lot of other people, the kind of bodies he left in his wake.
Do you think he was sincere?
I do think he's sincere, and maybe that's wishful thinking on my part. That's kind of a little mystery there. In fact, some of his closest Republican colleagues, Ed Rollins and Mary Matlin, kind of claimed, no, it was just the brain tumor talking. It wasn't really, he wasn't really recanting his life in Republican politics. But I don't see why he wouldn't. I don't think he had anything to gain by lying about something like that. I think it was very sincere. Mm. And, you know, Southern Baptists tend to have pretty sincere deathbed conversions.
Let's listen to a clip, finally, of Lee Atwater, the musician. This is him from the song Bad Boy from his 1990 album Red Hot and Blue, which had an all-star R&B lineup. Well, I'm a bad boy. I'm a long, long way from home. Yeah. Well, I'm a bad, bad boy. Well, I'm a long, long way from home. Yeah. Came up from Carolina. Mommy, you know I got to move to Rome. Can't help but laugh to hear him singing about himself being a bad boy a long, long way from home.
Not a lot of Republican blues artists out there, so yeah.
Do you touch on Lee Atwater, the musician, in the show?
We do touch on it a little bit. Thankfully, the play is not written with that as the focus because I like to tell people I don't really hate humanity enough to inflict my musical skills upon them. So, you know, I get to pick up the Stratocaster and kind of play with it, but I don't actually play it, nor do I sing. Yes. Although you will hear actually that song in the show.
Really?
Yeah.
And Veda, anything else to tell us about the show?
Just that it's very informative and part funny and part sad. And I knew nothing about Lee Atwater before I started.
Really?
I'm not a political person. It's changed my reading completely. Now I know Ed Rollins and Lee Atwater and all these people. And I know that if your positives are weak, you accentuate the negatives in a campaign.
And we should say this is not a new play. It's about 10 years old, isn't
it? It was written in 94, but oddly, it's only been produced about 9 times around the country in that time.
And why now in Sacramento? Can either of you say?
I can. I found the play 3 years ago. I've been trying to get it produced for 3 years. So I would have liked to have done it 3 years ago. But certainly, we are in the age of the perpetual campaign, and I think it's always relevant.
That's Eric Baldwin, actor who plays Lee Atwater, the late Republican political consultant in the one-man show Atwater, Fixin' to Die. It opens October 9th at the Threepenny Playhouse in Midtown Sacramento on 25th Street. It runs through November 8th. Also with us, Veda Russell, who directed the show. Eric, Veda, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You're welcome.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Miranda Fox, Michelle Grafis, and on his first day at Insight, Jason Kanger. Welcome, Jason. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. Legendary singer-songwriter Peter Yarrow is coming to Sacramento on the next Insight. We'll talk with the Peter, Paul, and Mary founder about his new role as a best-selling children's author. Also, you'll meet some members of the Davis High School Baroque Ensemble and hear them perform live in our studio. And more sound advice from jazz music host Gary Vercelli. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.